Welcome to Education Currents, a show designed to provide current educational news and commentary from a Christian worldview. The greatest resource any community has is its children, and by providing for them the best possible education, we are providing for ourselves and future generations. Join us as we explore the latest social and political issues surrounding education. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rose Gamblin and
Dr. Richard Tulin.
Welcome to Education Currents. I'm Dr. Richard Tooley, and with me today is William Federer. I'd like to get maybe a little bit of background information about what got you into history.
Well, years ago, I was noticing how we have God in our coins, God in our pledge, and yet there was this movement to take God out of our country, and I decided to go to the library and check out a book about what the founder said about God, and couldn't find one. So I decided to read through all the messages and papers of the presidents. I was amazed to see John Adams declaring a day of fasting and prayer when there was a threatened war with France in 1798, when James Madison declared a day of fasting and prayer when the British burnt the White House, Zachary Taylor having a day of fasting and prayer when there was a cholera epidemic in 1849, when Lincoln was in the Civil War, he had a day of fasting and prayer. Even Woodrow Wilson in 1918, when we entered World War I, had a day of fasting and prayer. I'm thinking, I never heard this before. And so I would take all these quotes and type them into my 386 computer. Shows you how long ago that was. And then I read through all the journals of the Continental Congress. And then I read through the different colonial charters, found something interesting. Every colony was started by a different Christian denomination. So Virginia was Anglican, Massachusetts was Puritan, Rhode Island was Baptist, New York was Dutch Reformed, Delaware and New Jersey were Swedish Lutheran, Maryland Catholic, Pennsylvania Quaker, Connecticut, New Hampshire Congregationalists, and they did not get along. And they would chase each other out of each other's colonies. But then they had to work together against the King of England. After that, they began to tolerate each other. Their attitude was, we may not agree on religion, but you are willing to fight and die for my freedom. I need to let you practice your faith. And then in 1776, 98% of the country was Protestant. 3 million people. 30,000 Catholics in the whole country is like 1%. And they were only in three colonies, New York, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. And there was only 1,500 Jews in the whole country. And they were in seven synagogues. But the country was 100% Judeo-Christian, but it was primarily Protestant. And then I read through every state constitution and every revision to every state constitution. I guess I have trouble sleeping. And I found that between 1776 and 1790, the original state constitutions for nine states required you to be a Protestant Christian to hold state office. I mean, right there, black and white, 1778, South Carolina Constitution says, the Christian Protestant religion is hereby deemed the established religion of this state. North Carolina's original constitution says, no person who denies the being of God or the truth of the Protestant religion shall hold any office in this state. Now, three states were a little liberal. Maryland said all you had to do was be a Christian. We think of that as narrow-minded. You mean only Christians could hold office in Maryland? No, that was generous, because just prior to the Revolution, you had to be an Anglican Protestant. Here, you could be any denomination of Protestant and even Catholic. That was pretty liberal. Another liberal state was Pennsylvania. Ben Franklin signed that constitution that said all you had to do was believe in the divine inspiration of the Old and New Testament. In other words, you not only had to lay your hand on a Bible to swear into office, you had to swear you believed in the Bible. But the most liberal state was the most evangelical state, Rhode Island, founded by Baptists. It had zero religious requirements to hold state office. They had this attitude that if you required someone to be a Christian, they could say they were just to get elected, and if they weren't, that would be hypocritical. Could you imagine a candidate saying they're Christian just to get elected?
That would be kind of a difficult thing in this day and age. It's interesting to see how the country has shifted quite dramatically away from an original position where, I guess I would call it the social contract of the nation, which hopefully is still intact, was based on God giving us the right to give the government the right to govern. And that is pretty interesting to me. Did you find that to be the case, or did I state that correctly? Or?
Yeah, I found that fascinating, that you had religion under state's jurisdiction. And like a racetrack with 13 lanes, some states expanded religious tolerance a little faster, mainly Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, and Maryland. And some states were a little slower, like Massachusetts and Connecticut. Did you know that the Congregational denomination was the established denomination of Connecticut up until 1818? And in Massachusetts, it was 1830. You could not hold office in Massachusetts up until 1830 unless you were of the Congregational denomination. And so religion was under state's jurisdiction. Sort of like today, some states have smoking bans, others don't. Some states let minors drink alcohol, others don't. Some states have gay marriage and others don't. Back then, some states gave a little more religious freedom and some states didn't. But it was up to the states to decide. And what happened was you had three things that caused religion to go from being under the state's jurisdiction to going under the federal jurisdiction. And if you want, I can go through those pretty quick.
Sure. Take us through them.
So the first was the Irish potato famine. In 1846, millions of Irish Catholics died, and then they began to come across in large numbers, and the Catholic percentage of America went from 2% to 20% in like 10 years. And so there was a large anti-Catholic, anti-Irish immigrant backlash, and they put laws on the books saying no money is going to go to Catholic schools. They call them anti-sectarian laws, but they got on the books. And the second was evolution. In 1859, Charles Darwin had his Evolution of Species and Descent of Man, and he came up with this idea that species can evolve. And a person, Herbert Spencer, said, well, species can evolve, maybe other things can evolve. And he began to apply evolution to other areas of academia, including law. And so at Harvard, you had Christopher Columbus Langdell was the head of the law school, and his disciple was Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., the Supreme Court Justice, and he came up with the case precedent theory of law. Instead of going back to what the founders intended and reading Blackstone and Locke, and no, now you just take the most recent case and you can bend a piece of rebar a little at a time until you get it going in the opposite direction. And then the third ingredient was the 14th Amendment. So, the 13th Amendment ended slavery, and you had Republican Lincoln, right, ending slavery, and the Democrats in the South passed Jim Crow laws and bodes and the KKK, and so a Republican noticed how these freed slaves were not getting any rights in the Democrat South, and his name is John Bingham of Ohio, and he pushes through the 14th Amendment to force the Southern states to grant rights to the freed slaves. And someone said, well, this is sort of different than the first 10 amendments, which were limits on the federal government. And this is the federal government sort of telling the states what they can do. And couldn't this be a potential problem with the federal government getting involved in stuff in the states that's under state jurisdiction? And John Bingham said, I repel the suggestion that this amendment would ever be used by the federal government to usurp rights away from the states. Well, guess what? No sooner did it pass than that's exactly what they did. And you began to have these activist judges applying evolution to the legal process and saying, well, yeah, the founders may have said that, but we don't really care about the founders anymore. We're going to sort of bend this thing a little bit at a time. And so you had some cases where there were union strikes and the state government said, no more striking, and the federal government says, oh, we're going to get involved in the strikes. And then you had a farmer that's feeding his grain to his cows, and the federal government says, well, you know, by not selling your grain on the market and not buying grain on the market, you're affecting the interstate price of grain, so we're going to pass and make it illegal for you to feed your grain to your cows. It's like, ah. And then you have Jehovah's Witnesses that were knocking on doors saying things, and the states would outlaw this as a public nuisance, and they go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, well, they get to knock on doors, their freedom of religion. And then the Jehovah's Witnesses would pass out pamphlets saying don't pledge allegiance to the flag, and the states would outlaw it. It goes to the federal government. The federal government says, well, you know, freedom of the press, they get to do this. And then the Jehovah's Witnesses would set up loudspeakers outside of churches on Sunday and, you know, in their parks, and they would blast that the people inside were going to hell, and the state said, no, he can't do this. And then the Supreme Court said, well, freedom of assembly, they can do this. And then finally, you had a case where the Catholics were getting bus rides to their schools. And some of these states, way back when those anti-sectarian laws that were passed during the Blaine Amendments and the Irish immigration, the laws, states said, well, wait a second, we don't want to have the state paying tax money for these bus rides. And it goes to the Supreme Court in 1847. I'm sorry, 1947, it's Hugo Black as the justice. It's called Everson versus Board of Education. And the Supreme Court says the bus rides can continue, but now that you've appealed it, from now on, the federal government's going to be in charge of religion. It's no longer going to be under state's jurisdiction.
That led us now to a point where it seems like this nation is disavowing its religious roots or its God-based roots. Now, what is a real question? It seems to me what's driving an awful lot of education now for our young people is much more about science, and not only just science, but revisionist type of science, or science that is peer-reviewed, but the peers that review it are saying, well, it looks reasonable, so we'll simply accept it without looking at its foundation. Same thing would hold true, it seems, with history, the history of this nation.
Yeah, it is an incremental thing. You know, I brought you from the founders of the colonies, being from the different Christian denominations, up to the Civil War, and then the Revolutionary War, and then the first state constitutions, and then gradually the states expanded religious freedom, but then finally the federal government took religion out of state's jurisdiction. But then an interesting part is 1957, the Washington Ethical Society wants tax-exempt status, and the IRS said, well, you're not a religion. You don't get it. Well, they sue, and the Supreme Court says that ethical culture is a religion. They get tax-exempt status. Then there's 1960, a person, Torcaso in Maryland, wanted to be a notary. But the Maryland state constitution said you had to end your oath with, so help me God, and he didn't believe in God. And so he was not allowed to be a notary. He sues, and the Supreme Court says, well, there are new religions that do not acknowledge a supreme being, amongst them Buddhism and even secular humanism. So he got to be a notary. And then 1970, there's a draft dodger during the Vietnam War named Elliot Welsh, and he wanted to claim religious conscientious objector status as an atheist. And the Army says, no, you're going. He sues. And the Supreme Court said, atheism is a religion. He gets to claim religious conscientious objector status. And the Supreme Court says, when someone holds beliefs with the same conviction as those who believe in a traditional deity, to that person, those beliefs constitute their religion. Even in 2005, there was a atheist in the Wisconsin prison that wanted a room and time off for a non-Bible study Bible study. And he also wanted male pornography, and they wouldn't give it to him. Well, the prison says, no, you don't get a room, because the rooms are only for religious meetings. And he sues. It goes to the federal court. The federal court says, atheism is Kaufman's religion. He gets a room. And so, in other words, here we are, where we started with Christians founding the country, and now to not prefer one religion over the other, they kick God out. So the whole thing is backfired.
In other words, God gave the people of the nation the authority to give to the government to govern. As we look at it now, we see a nation that says, no, we're secular. And we've moved up through the history to show how we got to that point. Now we're faced with some interesting things coming down the future, particularly as it comes to identifying what religion is and how that religion fits with our Constitution and how the rights of religious people are going to be protected or lost.
Right. So we have seen that Western civilization has gone from Judeo-Christian to secular before it becomes Islamic. And all you have to do is look at Europe. Europe used to all be Catholic and then a Protestant Reformation. Then every city had a Jewish neighborhood called a ghetto, right? They weren't allowed to live anywhere else until, you know, Napoleon changed the laws. But so Europe was Judeo-Christian for 1,000 years. And they didn't always live up to it, but they had these verses bothering their conscience, like doing to others as you would have them doing to you. Then Europe went to neutral with the French Revolution. Robespierre puts a prostitute in Notre Dame Cathedral, covers her with a sheet, and said, this is the goddess of reason. Let's worship her. They get rid of the 7-day week, and they want a 10-day week, because they said 10 was the number of man, 10 fingers and 10 toes, and that way they wouldn't have to worry about the Sabbath. They actually came up with a 10-hour clock, right? 10 hours to the day, 100 seconds to the hour, 100 minutes to the... And it was an intense effort to de-Christianize France. And then Napoleon spreads this French secularism all around Europe, and Europe becomes secular. And everything's sort of fine for a while. And so they say, hey, nothing special about our Christian past. Bring him whatever. So into Europe comes all these new beliefs, including Sharia law Islam. And now it's throwing the car into reverse, saying you can beat your wife, honor, kill your daughter, and call Jews apes and pigs. And the Europeans are waking up thinking, how did we get here, right? Where there's 751 neighborhoods around Paris that have been so completely taken over by the Muslims, the best the police can do is put up a sign that says, enter at your own risk, right? ZUS, Zonas Urbanas Sensibles. And they're chasing the Jews out. And then 10 years ago, there were 3 mosques in Germany. Today, there's over 200. And then Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, the number one crime is rape. Muslim immigrant men raping European women because Muhammad permitted his men to rape the women they took in battle.
Yes, he would let them do that. What's interesting about this, and maybe you can shed some light on this, I noticed you've produced both a video and a book here on the subject of the Islamic conquest. What is it that causes a person whose orientation isn't even close to Islam, a person who was likely a secularist, I believe Islamic religion likes secularists, likes people who are atheists because they can convert easier. What would cause a person to convert to a religion that is quite strict?
It is one of these mysteries of of history. Originally, it was lust. Because if you entered into jihad, you could come away with 4 wives plus as many extra women as your right hand possesses. And then you were promised, if you died in jihad, you would immediately be greeted by 72 virgins. And so this is a strong sexual motivation for young men. Matter of fact, in the 1200s, there was a philosopher in Europe by the name of St. Augustine. And he actually wrote about this when he wrote his Summa Contra Gentiles. And he said how Muhammad promised his followers, he seduced them with promises of carnal pleasure. And anyway, so that was the first reason. And then we see that through the force of his arms, he forced others to convert. So people are like, well, you know, I don't really agree with it, but I don't want to die. I don't want to get my head chopped off. Okay, fine, I convert. And then we see there is this element of religious pride. And so Islam is a religion of works. And so inside of every person is this idea, well, hey, we're separate from God. It's like Adam and Eve having to put off fig leaves, you know. Cain thinking, okay, I got to worship. Now, God provided the lamb. And so when God made coats of skins for Adam and Eve, well, how do you make a coat of skin? I think something has to die. And the thought is, well, did God kill the animal on the other side of the garden and bring Adam and Eve some nice tailored outfits? Or do you think maybe he killed the animal right in front of them? And they witnessed the first death ever. And they're thinking to themselves, we're the ones that sinned, but this innocent animal's dying. And God wanted to make it really clear that this animal was dying in their place, that he strips the skin off the animal and puts it on Adam and Eve. Maybe it still had some blood on it. They were covered in the blood. And so for the rest of their life, they're wearing the skin of this animal that died in their place. And whenever God sees them, he sees them wearing the skin. And so this was the lamb slain from the foundation of the world. This was Adam and Eve telling Cain and Abel, right? And so Abel kills the lamb. And so it's this idea, God's on one side, I'm on the other side. My sins separate me from God, and the lamb paid for the sin. Anyway, but so the Judeo-Christian faith is based on the lamb, right? This yes. Redemption. But the Islamic faith, they don't have that. It's all works. There's no, I blew it, Allah forgive me. No, there's none of that. It's just works. And so this does appeal to people from a religious aspect of feeling that you have to do works. And then when you do works, you can be proud and of the works that you did and thinking that you did more than the other person. And so there's this pride there. And then when you get your pride hurt, you want to lash out. Like when Cain got his pride hurt, that's when he decided to kill Abel.
Yeah.
And so there is this religious element of Islam that is an integral part of it. And so we see that Muhammad transitions from being a religious leader from 610 AD to 622 AD. And then Muhammad becomes a political leader in Medina. And then when Muhammad's followers get chased out of Mecca, he allows them to rob the caravans. And he gets a whole chapter of the Quran on how to distribute booty from robbing caravans. And so where Jesus said, if they take your coat, give them your shirt, Muhammad's attitude was, if they take your house, you retaliate, take their caravan. And so the Meccans send 1,000 soldiers to protect their caravan, and Muhammad and his warriors with 300 defeats 1,000. in the year 624 AD, the Battle of Badr, B-A-D-R, Badr. And so this amazing victory convinces Muhammad to be a military leader. And he fights in 66 battles in the next 8 years, even used the catapult when he attacked a city called Al-Ta'if. And when he was told the catapult was killing women and children, his response was, they are among them. So they got to be killed too. So suicide bombers today, say, and ISIS killers, say it's okay to kill innocent people to advance Islam because Muhammad did. And so since Muhammad was the perfect Muslim, Muslims that want to be better Muslims are wanting to be like him, religiously, politically, and militarily. So there's freedom for all religions in America. But Islam is not just a religion, because Muhammad was not just a religious leader. He was a political and a military leader. So a mosque is a religious building, a political building, and a military building. Bowing to Mecca is a religious bowing, a political bowing, and a military pledging of allegiance to another capital. In our effort to split the religious side of Islam away from the political military side, is we're trying to split their prophet. Who are we to tell them, only copy Muhammad when he was in Mecca as a religious leader. Don't copy him anymore when he was in Medina and he became a political military leader. So, yes, over the centuries, there are Muslims that have developed habits of being peaceful. And I'll go so far as to say that the majority of Muslims are peaceful. But the fundamental Muslims say, no, we got to get back to following Muhammad and the rightly guided caliphs who conquered from Arabia to Paris in 100 years. And so they are pressuring the moderate ones. And unfortunately, as they can cut off heads with impunity and the West does not respond, and now we see them encroaching into traditional Christian areas and the West is letting it happen, King Saul, who turns around and kills all the priests and takes their best land, gives it to the favorites. And, you know, one priest escaped to David, Abiathar. And so we see America's founders, when they were putting together our Constitution, they combed history for examples of people doing stuff other than kings. Because as history went on, these kingdoms keep getting bigger and bigger. So I mentioned, Sargon of Akkadia and Tilgath-Pilaser of Assyria and 2,000 years of Egyptian pharaohs and Cyrus of Persia and Alexander the Great and the Indian Maharajas and the 5,000 years and 18 major Chinese dynasties ruled by emperors and then the Roman emperors and the Byzantine emperors and the Muslim sultans and the King of Spain, France, and Austria and the Montezumas in the Americas and King Kamehameha in Hawaii and the African tribal chiefs. And everywhere you go, there were kings. But these empires keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger till finally the biggest empire that the planet had seen was the King of England. 13 million square miles and a half a billion people. The sun never set on the British Empire. They had Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, all of India, a quarter of the world's population right there. And we're going to break away from this king and we have no army and no navy. Just a bunch of courageous people. And so when we formed our government, we wanted to run as far away from a king as we could. And we took the power of a king, broke it into three branches, separated it federal to state level, and then tied up this federal Frankenstein with 10 handcuffs we call the first 10 amendments. So in a sense, all our Constitution is a bunch of hurdles to prevent the rubber band from snapping back into the hands of a king.
And so here we are now with the United States in this country in the year 2015. We're going to have to bring this interview to a close because we're right here at the end of the show. But I just want to remind people that you need to go out and get the book, What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, because I believe unapologetically that this nation stands in a crossroads, and we need to understand exactly which direction we want to go, because the choice from here on out to do nothing is not good. To do something is good, but we need to make it as an informed decision. I want to thank you for being with us here. And maybe you can tell us where we can get this book.
Well, thank you, Richard. My website is AmericanMinute.com. AmericanMinute.com.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
You have been listening to Education Currents, a production of MRG Media Ministries. For more on this or to contact us, go to mrgmediaministries.com. That's all one word, mrgmediaministries.com.